When there's something strange in your neighborhood, you know who to call. Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm explicitly ghost-free, so that's very nice.
Right, that's good.
I'm glad that you're also excited about that.
All right. Let's just keep going. Now, if you've never listened to FilmBookCast before, essentially we start with some film news, and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we'll move on into our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the new film from director Paul Feig and the remake reboot that has set the internet aflame, Ghostbusters. Are you excited, Mike?
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have a lot to say.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of talk about Ghostbusters over the past 2 years or so as this movie's being made online and stuff. So definitely a lot to discuss when we get into that. But before we get into Ghostbusters, let's get into some film news.
It's time for
So, film news this week, we have a couple things I wanted to mention, and a lot of them have to do with Star Trek, as a matter of fact, which is coming out next week, Star Trek Beyond, a week from, not a week from today, because we're recording this on the 17th, it's coming out on the 22nd, so very soon. Star Trek Beyond will be out in theaters, and one of the big changes that's going to be happening in Star Trek Beyond, not even a big change, because you don't really know that much about this character outside of his life on the bridge. Sulu, originally played by George Takei in the original Star Trek series and movies, and currently played by John Cho in the reboot cast, will be revealed as gay in Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah, that's, I feel like, a big step for... that to happen, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, Star Trek is actually, I think, has a reputation as one of the most progressive series and movies around. It actually, in the original series, it had the very first interracial kiss on television.
Yes.
That was a thing.
Yeah.
And so it's surprising at this point that there hasn't been a gay character in Star Trek before. But now it's 50 years in.
Wow.
And they finally got one around. And I think it's pretty cool that it's Sulu. Because it's sort of an homage to George Takei as an actor who revealed himself as gay back in 2005, I think.
Right.
However, George Takei doesn't think it's as cool as I do, which was a little surprising.
That is. That's interesting. I heard about his reaction, but I didn't read any of the articles or interviews or anything. So I don't know what's his stance? Why is it not as cool?
I mean, his argument is that it goes against Gene Roddenberry's vision for the character, and that he always portrayed Sulu as a straight person.
Mm.
Okay. And I'm not sure, like... and his defense also is that, I guess they told him that this was going to happen a while ago when they were writing the movie, and he, like, politely requested that they didn't do that.
Oh, I see. And they still did it.
And they still did it, and he is kind of upset about that. And so I think it's an interesting... debate to have. Like, does his argument hold weight? Like, is this progressive? I feel like this is progressive for the character and for the universe, but if George Takei doesn't feel that way, like, he has a certain perspective on this whole thing.
Yeah, I guess that he has a point that it doesn't hold to Gene Roddenberry's vision, but also that vision is 50 years old now, so why not update it, you know?
Right, yeah.
I guess it could have been any other character, and it seems like it's Hulu just because George Takei is gay.
Right.
But I mean, at least it's time. It's 2016 for that to be a thing, especially in the Star Wars universe, as you said.
Star Trek.
Or Star Trek, excuse me. Star Trek has always been the progressive. That's what science fiction is about and is for.
Yeah.
Is to do that. So I'm
to
glad
to go where no man's gone before.
Yeah, to use aliens as an allegory for things that we can't openly talk about in everything else.
Right.
So I'm excited that it's happening.
But anyway, so that's happening in Star Trek Beyond, and I think it's pretty cool. It's definitely good for the universe. And actually, yeah, one of the things about this is that, you know, George Takei, one of the things George Takei was against was that he didn't think I guess he feels like it's going to be like a big reveal that Sulu's gay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like as if he was closeted before and he's coming out of the closet in this universe. And right. he feels that would be against the Star Trek grain where everybody's more accepting and more open about certain things. Yes. Like you wouldn't need to be closeted if you were gay. Right. However, I don't think that's going to be the case that he was closeted throughout like the Star Trek films, especially since this was a reboot. So it's technically like Sulu from the beginning.
It's a new universe or whatever.
New universe Sulu or whatever. Yeah. The timeline doesn't really make any sense. But in any case, you know, it feels like it's not going to be like a reveal that he's gay. It's going to just show him like at home with his family and his like husband and son, I think is how it is. Because there's no inkling of Sulu's sexuality at all in either of the other J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies.
Right. Absolutely. As far as I remember. Yeah. I don't think you get a whole lot about any character other than Kirk.
Right. And most of the characters function as like their function on the bridge. That's like their job on the crew. And that's most of the characterization you get out of them. And that works for those movies.
Yeah.
But, I like it. I think it's a cool idea. But let's move on to the next Star Trek thing, which is that Chris Hemsworth might be coming back for Star Trek 4.
I mean, sure. Why not?
Well, I think this is pretty cool. So Chris Hemsworth was in Star Trek 2009, the first J.J. Abrams reboot. Chris Hemsworth played Captain Kirk's father in the opening scene, who then dies, and then the rest of the movie's about Kirk like 20 years later. Right. And that was before Chris Hemsworth was anybody. That was before he was a person.
Right. He hadn't even been born yet.
You know, Thor was 2 years away, and I remember when he was cast as Thor, everybody was like, oh, the guy who was in 5 minutes of Star Trek.
Star Trek.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
He's ended up being a huge star now. He's Thor, obviously. He was in the new Ghostbusters, which we'll be talking about in a little bit, so stay tuned.
Wow, nice, Mike.
But anyway, he might be coming back to Star Trek 4, and this is really interesting because it implies certain things that could happen in the timeline in this new Star Trek universe.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's good. I didn't even think of that, even though that's obviously what this story is about. Because I haven't seen the 2009 Star Trek or Star Trek Into Darkness in some time at this point.
Right.
So I didn't even remember that he was in the first one as Mr. Kirk or whatever. So it's cool. We've already established that, like, LOL, what's a timeline in this in these movies? So why not have him come back in the fourth one?
Yep. Yeah, no, I think it's cool. There could be, like, time travel and stuff, and have, like, Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth as, like, two Kirks in the same room kind of thing. I think that could be very cool. It could be really interesting. So I did want to bring that up pretty quick. And then, finally, the art house world of film had this had a massive blow a couple weeks ago, where in the same weekend, directors Michael Cimino and Abbas Kiarostami both passed away. Michael Cimino was well-known as the director of The Deer Hunter. He also directed Heaven's Gate, which was widely panned as one of the biggest disasters of all time when it was first released. But people have come around on it a lot in the past few years. It's now, like, by some have seen as like a misunderstood masterpiece. And Abbas Kiarostami,
just like Speed Racer.
Speed Racer, Heaven's Gate.
Yep. Same level.
The two things. And Abbas Kiarostami, an Iranian filmmaker, has been doing world cinema for decades, and just recently has been coming out with some really incredible movies. Certified Copy was the one that stuck out to me. That movie was really incredible. I've only seen one movie from each of these directors, actually, The Deer Hunter and Certified Copy. Both of them really stuck with me. They were both really like emotional experiences. And I definitely want to check out more of their filmographies and work. But in any case, I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, these were two art house directors who had, like, a really powerful impact on film.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Deer Hunters is a movie that I've seen, but then kind of never really thought about or never thought about the director. Or so it's interesting that, you know, there's some things like that that are like tent poles for cinema, but then that's it. And then people involved kind of just fade away sometimes.
Yeah. After Heaven's Gate came out right after The Deer Hunter, like 2 years after. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's one of the most expensive movies of all time. It was like this massive undertaking that was a huge bomb at the box office. And like basically since Michael Cimino, it's like director jail. Like he never really made another movie in the studio system after that or anything on that same scale. So yeah, like The Deer Hunter was like the high watermark like of success in his career. And then after that, he faded into obscurity for a long time.
Yeah. But it is still tragic. So definitely want to get into more of their stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But before we can get into their stuff, we have to discuss the stuff that we're talking about this week. And that's in a segment that we call our discussions.
These are my discussions.
Just when I thought I could talk about movies all day, I talked about more. So we're going to talk about them today.
These are my discussions.
There is so much to see you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our
discussions.
All right, let's get into our discussions for this week. Mike, you've got one thing you wanted to talk about?
Yes, I do, Mike.
That was a very weird sentence phrasing that you had there.
I was going to try to make a joke that you sounded surprised that I had a thing to talk about, but I couldn't go anywhere, so I just gave up.
So instead, you sounded surprised as you were speaking.
Oh, hey, didn't see you there. The thing I wanted to discuss is a new HBO miniseries. It's called The Night Of. They only have the first episode air so far. I believe the second episode airs tonight, the 17th.
Yes.
So it's a miniseries about I believe he's Pakistani guy in New York. He's a college student, goes out, finds some girl, and cool shenanigans happen between the two of them. But he wakes up. Wait, oh, I'm getting there.
Your definition, your phrase for sex is cool shenanigans.
Well, there's other stuff. It's not where I'm going. They have an experience together, Mike. He learns things about himself, I think. However, that fun is cut short when he wakes up and she's dead. And it is a really intense, well-written, so far, crime drama, I guess. I'm not really sure where it's going. There's only one episode so far.
Right.
It does a really interesting and, I think, really cool thing so far in the first episode where, as this showing the events of the night, we kind of are hinted, or the camera shows us all the evidence that is left behind.
Yeah.
Where he goes into a gas station to buy a drink, and the camera is set behind the cashier, and it lingers on the security camera footage, and it does a lot of really cool things like that that just shows how stacked the deck is against this guy. And it's a really terrifying prospect to find how, I mean, we don't know as an audience yet. There's a, blackout time jump, what happened. So we don't know what happened, but we're definitely placed in the shoes of Naz, the protagonist. And it's terrifying prospect of how accidentally you could end up the lead suspect in something just by what, everyday things you do could be construed as evidence against you. And it's kind of terrifying.
Absolutely. Yeah. I saw this episode of The Night Of as well. And yeah, it was super stressful and super intense.
Yeah.
I really dug it. It was really fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm definitely excited. I believe it's going to be 7 or 8 episodes or whatever a HBO miniseries is nowadays.
Yes, yeah. All right, so that's The Night Of, and I'm definitely going to be using the phrase cool shenanigans.
There you go, you're welcome.
From now on. It's like, yeah, I met a girl last night, and some cool shenanigans happened, and...
Now... Everyone knows what you mean, man.
Exactly, that's what's so great about it.
Yeah.
All right, and then I have 3 movies I wanted to talk about, all of which were movies that we could have reviewed for the past week, couple weeks or
but
so.
But someone didn't see them. And right. I bet you know who it is, since I'm not discussing them.
Yes. I saw them, though, so I'll talk about them now. The first of which is The BFG, which is, of course, the Doom spinoff that we've been talking about for years. Eagerly awaited Doom spinoff starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
As the big fucking gun.
As the big fucking... It is a motion-captured gun.
Voiced by The Rock.
Voiced by The Rock. Now, this is the new Steven Spielberg film based on the Roald Dahl novel. And there are sequences in this movie that are, like, truly magical. There are other sequences that are simply interminable.
Wow.
There's not much of a story here. I think the movie works a lot better when it's channeling Spielberg more than it's channeling Roald Dahl. Because I think Spielberg's style kind of clashes with Dahl's style. You know, Spielberg has this, like, whimsical kind of air to everything he's doing in this movie, and it works really well. Then Dahl has this kind of, like, fart joke kind of, like, juvenile humor thing.
I mean, it is a kid's book.
Right. Like, but it's much of it is based on, like, juvenile humor and stuff, and that's fine. that's fine, but I don't think it, like, meshes well with what Spielberg's doing in this movie. I will say Mark Rylance as the BFG is amazing. He, like, that motion capture, and he brings that character and all of his eccentricities and language specifically. The language of that character is so, it feels like, if you were an actor, I feel like it would be so hard to get that down, because he just has a really odd way of speaking. But he brings it to life in a really convincing way, and I think it's a very unique movie for a kids' film in the modern day. You know, it's a lot of kids' movies. Like, I went to this movie and I saw trailers for all the kids' movies that are coming out this summer, and I saw trailers like The Secret Life of Pets and Ice Age 5 and like stuff like Storks and a bunch of other stuff, and all of them kind of look the same,
only mostly.
You know, and I'm not. I'm not saying they're bad necessarily. You know, I've heard The Secret Life of Pets is fine. I think Storks actually looks pretty funny. But most of them are like really hyper energetic movies.
Right.
That are like rapid fire, like characters come in and out. There's like a lot of physical humor. And this is a very like subdued movie for kids. And to its credit, the kids in my theater seem to really like it, which is kind of cool. And I think I just wasn't in the target audience for this movie. You know, I think it's partly what it was.
Yeah.
So I think it does play better for like young kids. But this movie does take weird turns. There's, you know, for the first like 2/3 of the movie, maybe you're mostly in the land of giants. And then the movie takes a very odd left field comedy turn for the last like 1/3 of the movie. It's a turn that's in the book. Like, it's the way the book goes. And have you read the BFG?
No, I have not.
Okay. I read it once when I was a kid. And actually, I don't think I even read it. Mostly what I remember is that I had a book on tape I had borrowed from the library. Mm. And all I really remembered from the book was that the guy doing the BFG's voice sounded really weird. Because he would do it. It's like, I am the BFG. Like, he sounded like a... this is a reference that'll go over your head, but Neil Campbell doing the timekeeper on Comedy Bang Bang.
Wow.
Which
that went over my head.
Yeah, that's what I figured. But he sounded like the timekeeper. But Mark Rylance does a much better job than whoever that guy was. But any case,
suck on that nameless book on tape guy.
Any case, I do think the BFG is worth seeing. There's a lot of there are sequences in the movie that are great, and there are some really cool like sequences that are all done one take that look a lot like have you seen The Adventures of Tintin?
Yes. Okay. I have.
Yeah. Remember the the one take scene in Tintin? That's like this big action scene.
Yeah.
It's like this big chase scene in Tintin. There's a couple of scenes in the BFG that are a lot like that.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah. So those are pretty neat, and so I think it's worth checking out, especially if you're a Steven Spielberg fan. One of the other movies I saw this weekend was Swiss Army Man, which is the new film from directors Daniel Scheinert and Daniel Kwan, or as they're credited in the movie, Daniels. It starts off and it says, a film by Daniels.
That's awesome.
And this stars Paul Dano as a man trapped on an island, and Daniel Radcliffe as a corpse who washes along the shore. And this movie is so unique, it's so fun, and it's so life-affirming and uplifting in its own like crude, fantastical way.
Yep.
This is easily one of my favorite movies of the year. It's so bold in its way, and it trusts the audience is just going to be along for the ride, even when that ride is just like boners and fart jokes. in many ways, it was similar to the BFG in that regard. But I think Swiss Army Man is more adult skewing.
But it's the highbrow version.
It's the highbrow version of the BFG, depending on your perspective. Anyway, yeah, it's really good. And Daniel Radcliffe's really good in the movie, and Paul Dano's really good in the movie. I expected Daniel Radcliffe to just be sitting around doing nothing for most of the movie, because you know, he's playing a corpse. But but he has a lot to do in the movie, and he's very good. And it feels like, you know, the veil of Harry Potter is finally starting to lift off of Daniel Radcliffe. He's doing a lot of really cool indie work now.
Yeah, Swiss Army Man is definitely a movie I had wanted to see. And especially after that whole continuing story of real Daniel Radcliffe and fake Daniel Radcliffe, where apparently the directors had a dummy made because they expected Daniel Radcliffe to not want to just lay in the sand every take. but he was like, no, I'll do it. So they never used this dummy. So they had this like whole thing online where Daniel Radcliffe would take it places with him, and like they were actually bonding and pretended it was real. And I'm like, all this stuff. So It's a lot of silliness going on.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of silliness in the movie. It's a really, really silly movie, but it's a lot of fun. Also, I saw The Purge Election Year, which is the third film in the Purge franchise, which is a series that I am an embarrassingly big fan of. You know, I would tell people that I was going to see The Purge Election Year, and they would kind of look at me like, really? Like, but I was pretty hyped for this one, because it turns the satire towards the politicians behind The Purge, just in time to reflect our current political climate, and it does it pretty effectively some of the time.
Only some of the time?
I don't think it goes as far as it could. You know, there's definitely more that it could have done with the concept, which is something that I could probably say about every Purge movie.
Yeah.
But that said, there is a ton of great imagery in this movie. The characters are more fun than the other movies, especially Michael T. Williamson, who was Bubba in Forrest Gump. He is fantastic in this movie. He's also in Justified. He played a villain in Justified. He's the standout in this movie for sure. And Frank Grillo returns from Purge Anarchy and does good work here as well. And it expands the concept pretty well. I don't think it reaches the surprising highs of The Purge Anarchy, which is the last movie, but I do think it's probably a more consistent film.
Okay.
You know, it really has, like, the ultra-violence down pat. It has, like, the imagery, like, is so good, and, like, at its best, like, it is, like, dizzyingly, like, realistic, almost. Not realistic, obviously, but also...
But, like, you could see it, maybe?
You know, it's like when The Purge came out in 2013, everybody's like, this could never happen. And then now that The Purge 3 is out in 2016, it's like, man, this...
We're four months away from that.
What a reflection of our times.
Isn't that sad, though?
A little bit.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. But anyway, that's The Purge Election Year. So of those three movies, I mean, Swiss Army Man was easily the best, but The BFG is definitely good if you're a Spielberg fan, and The Purge Election Year... worth checking out, especially if you're a fan of the Purge films. But yeah.
Okay.
So I'm actually curious to see if there's going to be more Purge movies, because this one kind of ends in a way that makes me think they're over. But at the same time, it did pretty well at the box office, and then they're pretty cheap to make, so I feel like they'll find a way to make another one.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on if in 4 months' time the Purge is put into law and then we never have more movies again.
That's the thing. So. In The Purge Election Year, it establishes that the first Purge took place in 2016.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Wow, they're really going all
they
in.
They were not being subtle at all.
That's crazy.
Right? But anyway, yeah, so that's the movies. That's our discussions for today. Let's get into our featured review, Mike, of Ghostbusters.
It's a class 4 apparition. It's okay. She seems peaceful.
My name is Erin Gilbert, doctor of particle physics. That stuff went everywhere, by the way, in every crack. Very hard to wash off.
We have dedicated our whole lives to studying the paranormal. Now there's sightings all over the city.
There are people out there that need our help.
Holtzman, you're a brilliant engineer.
Erin, no one's better at quantum physics than you.
We can provide a real service.
I'm joining the club.
You guys are really smart about this science stuff, but I know New York. And I can borrow a car from my uncle.
You didn't disclose that the vehicle was going to be a hearse.
It's a Cadillac!
Let's go.
Let's go.
I'll let you.
Next time.
Okay, that was from the trailer for Ghostbusters, the new film from director Paul Feig, written by Paul Feig and Katie Dippold, who used to write on Parks and Recreation, and co-wrote The Heat with Paul Feig. And the movie stars Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, Leslie Jones, Chris Hemsworth, Cecily Strong, Andy Garcia, and Neil Casey, among others. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, following a ghost invasion of Manhattan, paranormal enthusiasts Erin Gilbert and Abby Yates, nuclear engineer Jillian Holtzman, and subway worker Patty Tolan band together to stop the otherworldly threat.
Pretty good job, IMDb.
Yeah, solid work. One of your better synopses, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so Mike, let's talk about our relationship to Ghostbusters, the franchise. I love the original movie, and I've definitely seen Ghostbusters 2, but I barely remember it.
That's fair.
You know, like, I've seen Ghostbusters, the original, many times, and I feel like I've definitely seen Ghostbusters 2. I might have even seen it twice when I was young.
But you're not sure.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I was like, yeah, it's Ghostbusters 2. It's whatever. Yeah. And there's, like, stuff... I kind of remember, like, all the ghosts kind of attacking Manhattan towards the end of that movie. Actually, I mean, we'll get into spoilers later, I guess, but the ending of this movie kind of echoes the ending of Ghostbusters 2 in the all-out chaos
right.
in Manhattan kind of way. I was pretty ambivalent about a potential Ghostbusters 3 for a long time.
Yes, and I do remember that those rumors going around.
Yeah, and like Dan Aykroyd's been trying to make this movie happen for a long time.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Bill Murray wanted nothing to do with it, which is kind of their big setback. Like, Dan Aykroyd right. wanted to do it. I think he wrote a script with Harold Ramis, and it just never materialized because Bill Murray, like, they kept sending it to Bill Murray, and he would always be like, no.
Just doing his Bill Murray thing.
Exactly. And then the death of Harold Ramis a couple years ago seemed to kind of signify the end of a Ghostbusters sequel.
Right.
Right. And then the studio kind of started moving around some other things, and there was other rumors going around. Finally, Paul Feig was attached to reboot the franchise, and he announced that his movie was going to star all women, which was the first time I'd ever been interested in Ghostbusters yeah. sequel, reboot, whatever it was going to be.
Right.
So I'm like, what do you think about, I mean, what's your relationship to Ghostbusters? What's your talk about the franchise? Give me your whole spiel.
Yeah, so Ghostbusters I've seen a whole bunch of times. I don't, the same situation, I've probably seen Ghostbusters 2, but, like, I don't really remember it at all.
Yeah.
However, it's one of those things that I haven't seen in a long time, and it's not something I'm extremely passionate about, Ghostbusters, where apparently everyone else is the most important movie of their life.
yeah, there's been a huge, I mean, like, the internet, let's say backlash slash hype. Yeah. Surrounding this movie has been insane.
Yes. So that said, I was a similar situation where, you know, Ghostbusters 3 would be cool. It'd be interesting, I guess. But then when Paul Feig said he's going to do the all-female reboot, I was like, yes, I'm in. This will be the best thing ever.
Right.
It'll be the chance for them to skewer everything and everything about Hollywood. It'll be wonderful. And then the first trailer came out, which I think is kind of when everything coalesced into just pure Ghostbusters hatred.
Right.
I've never seen before about it.
Yeah.
On this scale. But I had a similar reaction where I think that first trailer wasn't put together very well or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it directly referenced the original one, but then it was setting up a reboot, which had a lot of weird lowbrow jokes in it, which was, I don't know. So then I kind of lost some interest, or at least wasn't as hyped anymore. I thought that I was really nervous that they had fumbled their chance at what this movie could have done. And however, after seeing it, I think that it did what it could do. It was way better than the trailer had let on. and I was pleasantly surprised by a lot of it.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. The trailers were okay, I felt like, but I also knew going in that trailers for Paul Feig movies are usually not as good as the actual movies themselves. Except the trailers for Spy in particular made it look pretty bad. Yeah. But Spy ended up being pretty funny. Like, it was a very good movie, and it got a lot of critical acclaim. Everybody really dug that movie. Right. That said, I mean, and he also did Bridesmaids, which was really great. That was a huge, like, monster hit when that came out. Yeah. He also did The Heat, which is a movie that's, and this was co-written by Katie Dippold, who also co-wrote The Heat. And I wasn't a big fan of The Heat. Like, it just didn't really work for me. And part of that was because I think Feig hasn't always been the strongest visual director.
Mm-hmm.
I think his strengths mostly lie in his performers, letting them kind of riff and improv and then figuring out how the scene's going to go from there. So I was pretty mixed in The Heat, which has some funny moments, but required an eye for action that just wasn't really there. But Spy, I thought, showed a lot of improvement in that regard. I thought it got me more on board. And then this, Ghostbusters, is easily the most visually complex movie that Feig has ever done.
Yeah.
And I think he mostly succeeds.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah. But still, his greatest strength is his performers, and the cast here is incredible. And I think that's part of the best part. This is the best part about this movie, is that the core Ghostbusters team works great together. You know, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, and Leslie Jones. Kate McKinnon, to me, is absolutely the standout here.
Yeah, she's definitely the most interesting character out of all of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, she's doing a lot of the stuff that she would do on SNL. She's a very weird kind of performer. And that she brings that kind of weird energy to this character, which is really great. Also, Chris Hemsworth is a lot of fun. He's a blast to watch. He's really funny. And I'm hoping that, like, after all this, like, Thor stuff blows over, he just goes straight into comedy.
That'll be it. I just love the fact that how much backlash his character is getting for being written purely his appearance and just being objectified by the female Ghostbusters for how handsome he is. Which that's the kind of thing that I remember when they announced that Chris Hemsworth was going to be the boneheaded secretary. It was just like, yes, go do it. Do it, please.
Exactly.
And they did it. And it's amazing. So yeah, I agree. I hope he is going to be one of those people that has a bright future, like The Rock, in being a huge action star, but also being really funny.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's like great appearances from comedy people that are just kind of like have like bit parts throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Like Matt Walsh in this, Michael K. Williams, who's not a comedy person, but he's in it.
But he's in it, which is hilarious.
Zach Woods, Ed Begley Jr. They make the most out of their comedic window. They always have like, you know, pretty solid parts. Also, Charles Dance, Tywin Lannister, is in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I recently saw a soundbite or whatever from Paul Feig where he said he cashed in every single chip that he possibly could on this movie. And he got and he said that if this doesn't work, he goes to director jail. That's it. It'll be over.
Yeah.
So I haven't looked at the box office for the film yet. I guess it's the weekend's not over.
Right. I mean, I think it's looking like it's going to do solid business. It's tracking towards like a 45 million debut. It's going to open in second, I think. Only because Secret Life of Pets was huge when it opened up last weekend. Yeah. So it's probably going to stay at number one. But, you know, it's opening debut is pretty good for a live action comedy.
Yeah.
It's not great for a movie that costs like $150 million to make.
Right. Yeah.
But it's pretty good. Like I think it'll, and it could have legs. I think the general reaction to this movie is pretty positive overall. You know, taking like this movie definitely has problems. I feel like it definitely is too reverential towards the original movie. I think it's mostly its own thing, but I feel like there are a lot of like callbacks and stuff that do bug me. Throughout. And we'll get to a lot of those in spoilers.
Okay.
But for the most part, this movie works very well. And it's funny throughout, which is the most important thing.
Right.
You know, because if it's not funny, then what's the point of doing a Ghostbusters movie? You
know? Yeah, it does walk this fine line, I guess, a little bit between, like I said, I haven't seen the original in a few years, so I don't remember there being a lot of action, like straight-ahead action movie action.
Right. I mean, there's definitely a lot of set pieces in the original Ghostbusters, too.
Okay.
The original Ghostbusters, not the original Ghostbusters 2. Although probably in the original Ghostbusters 2 as well.
Probably.
I feel like that's my favorite recurring joke of this podcast, is where I'll say the original blank 2 or whatever, and then I'll have to clarify. That's a peek behind the curtain.
What are we going to do without our Doom movie references now? Anyway.
Exactly, right?
Tragic. But I do understand this film was made to give the female cast a chance to be the action heroes, and I think the action for the most part works. There's some... You know, it's not crazy, insane stuff, but there is some fun being had in the third act, I think.
Yeah, well, I do think the third act kind of loses the film a little bit. I think the CGI theatrics kind of start to overshadow the team interplay that had kind of been the highlight of the movie that up to that point. But the third act is fun. I did enjoy watching it. Like I said, for the most part, it's its own thing, this movie. I think the characters in this movie bear very little resemblance to the characters in the original movie. What they could have done is like graft personalities from the original onto these new characters. And I think that would have been a mistake. Now you have these new characters and you kind of let these performers kind of bring their own comedic voice into these characters. I think that worked very well.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, the plot also kind of boils down to Ghost Attack New York City. Like at their core, it's the exact same thing, but also it does enough different and it feels fresh enough that didn't really bug me.
Yeah, I would agree.
Also, I was happy that they used the original Ray Parker Jr. Ghostbusters theme, at least a little bit.
Yeah, that was one of the things that this being a Sony movie, it felt like this got real commercial a lot, which kind of is just a pet peeve of mine.
Okay, what do you mean by it got real commercial?
We get a couple like lingering shots on the camera they're using, and it's like Sony 4K, like written in huge things. They also are in an apartment in Manhattan. They order pizza and it's Papa John's. Like, I don't even think there are Papa John's in Manhattan.
Because they know they can't compete.
Yeah, come on. That's just a pet peeve of mine. But I forget where that was going to go, so it doesn't matter. with the theme song. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Theme song, yeah. So this new Fall Out Boy and Missy Elliott have a new theme song for this movie.
Which we talked about last episode.
Right. And there was the moment when the theme song is going to hit, and it's the original theme song.
it was great.
Really confused, which felt a lot like it's just Sony Records putting a song in a Sony movie. But luckily, we get only one verse, and it's the Missy Elliott verse when it happens in this.
Right, when the new one happens. But in the opening scene, which I thought was great, the whole this thing with Zach Woods as the tour guide.
Yeah.
Having some very funny lines, and then getting haunted by this ghost, and then you see him like hanging over like a scaffolding, and he's like, the ghost is attacking him. He's like, ah! And then the screen starts to fade to black, and it starts to say Ghostbusters, and you hear the opening credit, like the opening theme. Like
the original,
those chords of the opening theme, and it made me laugh a lot. Like that's it sets the tone for the movie really perfectly, I think.
Yes.
You know, it's such a perfect theme song for a Ghostbusters movie. Like, why wouldn't you use it? You know?
Yeah, how could you not?
And I was afraid they weren't going to use it because they had this Fall Out Boy version.
Yeah, that's what I thought that was going to happen.
So the Fall Out Boy only plays that one part, like in the middle of the movie, which, whatever. They probably could have used the original version there too, but.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. They could have used that everywhere.
the end of every scene should have just ended with the Ghostbusters theme.
It's like the slap bass in Seinfeld.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a transition music.
Yeah,
and I would happily watch this cast together again for a sequel if that's how it's going to go down. Especially if that sequel loses all the references to the original.
Yes.
To just completely be its own thing. Because I will talk about those in spoilers, but there are some stuff that bugged me. There's stuff that worked, I thought, like that referred back to the original movie. And there's stuff that I felt was very organic. And then there's other stuff that felt like very shoehorned in. We'll talk about that in spoilers. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Mike, before we get into spoilers?
Well, I just wondered what your thoughts. You said at the end, in the third act especially, there's the CGI stuff going on, kind of overshadows everything. But up until that point, what did you think about the way the ghosts look?
Oh, good. Yeah, I think the ghosts look pretty good. Like, they have a kind of a unique look to them, like something that you don't really see in a lot of big budget movies these days. Like, they look kind of cartoony, but sort of realistic.
They like half look like a Scooby Doo monster.
Kinda, yeah. But they look more realistic than the ghosts did in the original Ghostbusters.
Yeah, which is a thing. I don't remember what they looked like. but I thought it was a nice blend of. It looked like, for the most part, it was a person in a costume, or at least their face in a costume, and then everything else was kind of flowy and misty, and like they were backlit. They had this weird fluorescent blacklight thing going on, but I thought it all sort of worked. Where this movie is kind of going for the silliness of it, and it
absolutely.
At some point there's some spooky tense stuff happening with the basement and the mansion in the beginning. Is you know, there's some like half creepy things, so I thought the ghosts looking. Being half creepy, half silly was a nice.
Yeah, it was a nice touch. And definitely, like, it was going for the silliness, and it succeeded because it's a Ghostbusters movie. It should be pretty silly.
Yeah.
All right, should we get into spoilers, Mike?
Yes.
All right, let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for Ghostbusters starting right now. So, spoilers for Ghostbusters starting right now. So, what did bug me a little bit was how reverential this movie was to the original movie. And, like, I get it. We all love Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like, you don't have to convince me that we like Ghostbusters. I'm with you.
I remember Ghostbusters.
And some of the callbacks felt pretty organic. I thought Dan Aykroyd's cameo, for example, was pretty good. Like, that was very funny.
Yeah, his was really funny.
And didn't overstay its welcome. But, like, I didn't need to see Slimer again.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't. And they did integrate him into the narrative pretty effectively, but that could have been any ghost, and it would have been the same.
And it would have worked, yeah.
I also didn't need to see the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man again. same deal.
Yeah, I thought that was at least a clever way to get him into it. Like he's a parade float or balloon.
Yeah, that's true.
But other than that, it was kind of like, yep, remember that thing.
And it's like, I don't really need to see the origin of the Ghostbusters logo, for example, like shoehorned into like a graffiti segment of the...
Yeah.
Thing. Like, I thought that was a little much. Although, speaking of the logo, I do like that it kind of ends up being the villain of the movie.
Yeah.
Rowan turns into the Ghostbusters logo. And it does it in like a cute little cartoon form first, which is really funny animation bit there. And then it becomes a much larger, eviler version.
Yeah, it starts in like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit style type thing.
Which is cool. Like, that was interesting. It's something you don't see that much. But let's talk about the cameos. So, Dan Aykroyd, I thought was pretty good. The rest of the cameos, though, Bill Murray, Ernie Hudson, Sigourney Weaver, and Annie Potts all make cameos in this movie. And yes. For me, I would say I wouldn't rank any of them above, like, fine. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's a Harold Ramis one, sort of, in the very beginning.
I didn't catch that, actually. What do they do for
So when Kristen Wiig's in her office and she's her Tywin Lannister guy, I can't remember, I don't remember his name.
Charles Nance.
Yeah, he walks in and talks to her, and as he's exiting their office, he walks into the hallway and turns right, and it lingers, and there's a bust, like a statue in the hallway of Harold Ramis.
Okay.
Like, okay. He's supposed to be somebody, like a whatever, in the, where she worked at Columbia, I think?
Columbia or something University, like that. Which is where I think at least one of the characters in the original Ghostbusters worked at Columbia, probably Harold Ramis.
Probably, yeah.
Any case, I might have missed that, because I did see this movie under not perfect conditions. I saw this at a drive-in movie theater.
Oh, no.
Which, I mean, you've never been to a drive-in, Mike.
No, we were talking earlier. I have not.
Well, a drive-in, it's a cool experience. Like, if you've got a girl with you or something, that's fun.
And it's the 1950s.
Exactly. Or if you're hanging out with your friends and you just want to chill outside and watch a movie or something.
Yeah.
Great. But I went there as a family trip, and we went. And the drive-in's cool, but it's not an ideal place to watch a movie for the first time, in my opinion, because you're watching it on a screen that is fairly far away, and you're listening to it through the sound of your car radio, so all the sound gets compartmentalized.
Yep.
Plus, you're dealing with cars that are driving back and forth with their headlights on throughout the movie. And, you know, like, there's the car next to us was running for, like, a half of the movie's runtime.
Wow.
Like, the engine was just on, and so you would hear it. And
yeah.
So I didn't see this under the ideal circumstances, so if my review feels colored by that in any way, that would be the reason why.
Makes sense.
And that's probably why I missed the Harold Ramis bust in Columbia University.
Yeah, it's pretty early in the movie also.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would agree that other than Dan Aykroyd's, it's kind of like, sure. The other cameos, especially the Sigourney Weaver one. That the whole credits thing, I guess we'll talk about, was really weird.
Yeah.
For me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, definitely. And they all kind of felt like roles that like anybody could have played. Is the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know. I guess the next best one was probably the Ernie Hudson one. I thought was pretty good.
Like, solid. I thought that was a pretty clever way to put him in.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, when you have them in there, I feel like the best you could say is, "Oh, that's a clever way to put them in." But, like, that's not a necessary part of this movie, like, for the story to be told or for... And, like, I just want jokes. I just want funny stuff happening in my Ghostbusters movie. And, like, that was kind of funny, but...
Yeah, I mean, at least the Dan Aykroyd one was pretty funny.
The Dan Aykroyd one was pretty good. And that felt like there was so much chaos going on. And, like, that was felt like a perfect, like, comedic moment for that scene. Like, that was very good. That was well done. Also a weird cameo. Ozzy Osbourne shows up at the metal show.
Yeah,
for a joke that just falls completely flat.
Yeah, there were a couple things, a couple jokes in my theater that it's so awkward when a joke doesn't land.
Yeah, and that was absolutely one of them.
That was one of them. The other one that didn't land for me in my theater was at the mansion in the beginning when he's there. He's like, "Oh, this is the room they say P.T. Barnum first had the idea to enslave elephants,"
that made me laugh a lot. Actually,
it was just so awkward, especially like an animal cruelty joke, and like, no one laughed at it. It was really funny. Anyway,
that line did make me laugh. I thought that was pretty funny. Let's talk about the after credits scene. Did you stick around for the whole credits?
The whole credits? No, I didn't make it all the way through.
There's a scene at the very end of the credits that you missed. teasing the sequel. So I'll talk about it.
Okay.
If you don't care about being spoiled about it.
I don't care.
We're in spoilers, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you care or not. The end of the movie ends, and it's all the Ghostbusters hanging out in their room, at their lab or whatever. Kate McKinnon has, like, this little device, and Kristen Wiig's playing with it, and she's like, and Kate McKinnon's like, "I call it the Nutcracker." And Kristen Wiig's like, "Oh, because, you know, you get the ghosts," and it goes, like, she makes, like, a motion, and Kate McKinnon's like, "No, that's for walnuts." And it was like, "Oh, that makes sense." And then Leslie Jones, who is like listening to like a recording, says like, "Hey guys, I'm hearing something weird on this recording." And she like listened to it, and she looks up and is like, "Who's Zool?"
And
and then it cuts to black. Which I thought was a pretty, like, that's a kind of clever, like, you know, it implies that Zool will be in the next movie in some capacity.
Right.
You know, kind of clever, but...
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. You liked my description of it.
I liked your description of it. But yeah, there's this weird thing that happens with the credits where, like, we'll see, like, two or three credits names, and then we cut to a scene that, like, probably should have just been in the movie, and then, like, we see a couple more credits, and we cut to another one, and it was really weird.
I kind of liked those. I thought they were all pretty solid scenes, and also, right after all those, like, scenes end, the credits are great, because it's, like...
Just the dance scene?
It's Chris Hemsworth dancing, and he's, like, making, like, pointing motions, and when he points, the credits, like, move over to where he points.
Yeah, it's really weird. Especially, well, that whole thing, because he's, like, controlling that crowd of soldiers and cops right. and stuff. Because, like, when that scene happens in the film, it's pretty obvious that it's going to be a dance scene, because they all strike a pose.
Right.
And then it's saved for the credits.
That is a little weird.
Which was so bizarre. That was just the only thing I noticed about that.
Yeah. So we will talk stuff spoilers more. Rowan is the villain of this movie. He's the bad guy played by Neil Casey. And he's also sort of the embodiment of everybody who's kind of upset that Ghostbusters exists.
There's a lot of really good jabs at, like, YouTube and the internet in general.
Right, yes. Yeah, so they were like, don't read the YouTube comments. And, like, the first one was, like, bitches can't bust no ghosts.
That was so good. And then they even, like, show a screenshot of some of them. And I was like, those are definitely real, I bet. Because YouTube is public. So
exactly. But Rowan ends up dying maybe like 2/3 of the way through the movie and becomes a ghost. And he starts possessing people left and right. He possesses Melissa McCarthy for a little bit for a pretty funny scene. And then he possesses Chris Hemsworth character, Kevin. And that becomes like the end of the movie. Like he's in Kevin's body and goes through all this stuff. I thought Chris Hemsworth played that very well. Like I was saying before, I think Chris Hemsworth is really solid in this movie. He's very funny. And he makes a lot of jokes about his stature. I think my favorite was when he's possessed and he goes into like this lab or whatever guarded by two guys and a guy calls him like, "Hey, Clark Kent." And it's like, "Clark Kent? Oh, because of the glasses and the handsomeness."
Yeah.
I think my funniest scene in this movie actually is the interview scene where they're interviewing Chris Hemsworth in order to get the job of secretary. And he's talking about, he asks if his cat could come and like live there with him. And he says, like, "Oh, can my cat come?" And they're like, "Oh, you have a cat?" And he's like, "No." And like, "But you just asked if your cat could come." "No, I asked if my cat could come. My cat is my dog." It's like, "Your dog's name is my cat?" "My dog's name is Mike Hat." And "Your dog's name is Mike Hat?" "Well, actually, his full name is Michael Hat." It's like, okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of really silly... I mean, there are some times where they go to a pretty good length to get to a joke and set it up. That one worked. But yeah, I did enjoy Chris Hemsworth's character. It's just like this just idiot, like, bumbling, handsome guy, and it's the best.
Yeah, and the ending of his last thing at the end, right when the Ghostbusters saved the day and he shows up and it's like, "Hey guys, we did it." And he's like eating a sandwich that he stopped at the deli to get like while they were fighting.
And he can't help but insert himself into their thing. It's so good.
And it was, he's eating the sandwich and then Liz McCarthy like, takes the sandwich and throws it. And then he's like, "Hey, a little help." And some guy throws the sandwich back at him. Just keep eating it.
Yeah.
That was great. That was really funny. So that was good. Otherwise, I mean, other thoughts about Ghostbusters, Mike? Any other spoilery things you wanted to discuss?
No, not really. I think for the most part, it sets out to do what it achieves what it sets out to do. It does manage to skewer a lot of Hollywood stuff and just the roles of gender and everything in these movies. And I think it does a really good job of upending them, especially with how smart and capable the Ghostbusters are, the female, the ghost girls or whatever they're called.
Right.
And then just fucking idiotic Chris Hemsworth is, and even Rowan's whole plan and like that whole he is spurned by society, so he has to destroy everything, and no one understands him, but he's just like really sad and
right.
I think it does a really good job, and this deserves to succeed in a very big way.
Yeah, hopefully it does, and I think I would definitely be excited for a sequel for this. I think it's very solid. It's not as good as the original Ghostbusters, but how could it be, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the original Ghostbusters is kind of like this, like lightning in a bottle, like to succeed on every level. But it's very good, big fan, and while I wish it could have been more of its own thing, it does enough differently than the original Ghostbusters to be its own thing. Just, you know, get rid of the callbacks and we'll really have something here, I think.
Right.
But yeah, Kate McKinnon's great, Chris Hemsworth great, cast works well together, Paul Feig, solid director choice. Solid B from me.
Yeah, I would put it there as well. That's another one of the things that it was good enough. Not great, I guess, but it doesn't need to be great, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I like it would have been great if it was great, but it's good, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good movie. It's fun.
Yes.
And it's definitely, this summer has been kind of like a drag.
Yeah.
There hasn't been that many great, like really good movies out. So this is definitely one of the ones to go see, I feel like, if you're mm-hmm. into going to see movies, which if you listen to this podcast, you probably are.
You must, or you're our friend.
All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our work at filmbook.com.
Don't cross the streams, Mike.
I'm crossing the streams. Good one. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike's Cree Show. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email because we produce so many different ones hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks where we'll be discussing Star Trek Beyond, probably, right?
Most likely.
Yeah. I guess it's either that or Jason Bourne.
Both at this point.
Probably both. Maybe both. We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
But definitely one of those two. I would probably put our money on Star Trek Beyond being the one if we do one.
Yeah.
But Jason Bourne definitely up there too. You can check out our next Complete Works where we'll be talking Red Rock West, which we were supposed to talk about a while ago, but we're going to talk about this week. So...
Because what even is a timeline?
That's exactly. This whole thing came full circle. That's
called a callback.
We said, just like the new Ghostbusters. Man, we are good. We are Paul Feig and Katie Dippold level humorists.
We are professionals that work for free.
Man, that's sad. All right, thank you guys so much for listening. We are out. I ain't afraid of no ghosts. Don't get caught alone, no, no. Ghostbusters! When it comes through your door, unless you're just a waltz mode, I think you better call.